Talk given Friday, 13th March 1981. The founders of the great religions and all the great spiritual teachers of the world have made so many remarkable affirmations in connection with what constitutes man's fulfillment. And they also made what may be called a promise. They gave a promise. And the promise, of course, is worded in different forms according to the particular religion and the country in which it flourished and so forth. For example, Zarathustra says this, it's in the Gathas, and those are the most authentic writings of Zarathustra. I said writings, but more correctly I should have said compositions, because they must have been handed down orally. There was no writing in those days. The Avestan and Zand languages came into being, as far as most of us really know, writing came into being long after the time of Zarathustra. I myself am inclined to think, from the internal evidence of the literature of the Gathas, that Zarathustra may have been contemporaneous with Abraham. The special evidence is this. They say Abraham heard the call and he left Ur, the city of Ur, and went westwards. And he heard the call because the Chaldeans had become caught up in what is commonly called practices of black magic and so forth. And they had degraded the original Kabbalistic teaching. So Abraham took the original Kabbalah with him as he went westwards. And that was the source of the whole of the Judeo-Christian tradition afterwards. Now, Zarathustra makes a similar complaint. He talks about the evil practices of the other sects. And he calls them the followers of the lie, L-I-E, lie. And he upheld, as he declared, the truth, the original truth as such. Now, that piece of evidence, I think, in the Gathas is pretty strong and makes me feel that he may have been, one can't say much more, he may have been a contemporary of Abraham. And Zarathustra says, whoever comes after the follower of or the teacher of holiness, his dwelling in future shall be the light. To him who is the friend of the Lord in spirit and action, Ahura Mazda will grant perfection and immortality, and out of his abundance holiness as well. And through his own overflowing strength, his might and majesty, and the firm support of his good mind. Now this is the promise held out to whoever will be a follower of the truth. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna declares, he who serveth me unfailingly by the yoga of devotion, he, crossing beyond the qualities, is fit to become Brahman. Though ever performing all actions, taking refuge in me, by my grace he obtaineth the eternal changeless abode. Merge thy mind in me. Remember, he is talking in the Gita to Arjuna. Merge thy mind in me, be my devotee, sacrifice to me, prostrate thyself before me. Thou shalt come even unto me. I pledge thee my troth. Thou art dear to me. Abandoning all other paths, meaning all other lesser paths, which were prevalent in his time, come unto me alone for shelter. Sorrow not, I will liberate thee from all sins. The Buddha says, going along in accordance with what is enjoined, the Noble Eightfold Path, essentially that means, having soon realized, here and now, by your own super knowledge, that supreme goal of the Brahma-faring, the living of the holy life, that is, for the sake of which young men of family rightly go forth from home into homelessness, you will abide in it, here and now whilst you are alive. That is the Buddha's assurance. And here are the words of Jesus, comes in St. John's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 23. If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him. There's something very charming about that formulation. Now, in all these cases, in connection with all these cases, it is interesting to try to see how many people understand just what these promises mean. One of the commonest human failings in the world is self-conceit. We believe we know. We believe we understand. If we do not, if that were not the case, our ego and our vanity would be very much hurt and upset. So we think that we know. We imagine that we know and understand. But if we are seriously concerned with living the religious life, it behoves us to look very, very critically and deeply into our own minds to find out whether we do really understand what the words stand for. What is one of our greatest difficulties in this process? From birth onwards, we are continuously conditioned by everybody around us. We are conditioned also by the way in which our senses naturally function. Also by the particular type of ductless gland system that we have, which is distinctively our own. It's different from everybody else's in the whole world. Now all these things function in such a manner that various concepts arise in our minds, various beliefs and ideas and so forth. And we think that these are true conceptions. Actually, most of them, and in some cases practically all of them, are misconceptions. Take, for instance, the words of Jesus. If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him. If a man love me, every one of us has his own image of what loving me means. And out of the 4,000 million people in the world today, practically all of them have a narrow, limited, possessive concept of what love means. Something which they want from the other person, if fulfilled, for them will signify that that person loves me. Now, as you'll see, this is rather absurd. Love has nothing to do with these conditional relationships between one person and another. It has nothing to do with obtaining, gaining from someone. Love in its reality, in its transcendental sense, is an absolute relationship in which what goes out from oneself to another is completely unconditional. There are no conditions laid down. There are no expectations involved. There are no hopes, and so forth. All that is out, because all those things belong to our psychical life in its impure state, in its dualistic state, an exchange and barter system state. Now that is not love. If a person can love in this manner or something like this, whatsoever you think, feel, say, or do unto me, it will make not the slightest difference to my complete self-giving of myself to you. It's a tall order, if you like. It's asking a lot. But that precisely is what love really means. When the interrelationship between, say, a man and his wife is of that nature, they totally and completely give themselves unreservedly, unconditionally to each other, and can live by that, then that is the perfect earthly expression of what we may call the marriage made in heaven. Because the idea of the marriage made in heaven has a very, very real meaning. And in the teachings of the Kabbalah particularly, this comes out in a very remarkable manner. So, if a man love me, and you know how Jesus gave his one and only commandment. He didn't give any other commandments. He always spoke in terms of the commandments which were laid down for his race, the Jewish commandment, the 10 Jewish commandments, and also thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy soul, and so forth, and thy neighbor as thyself. Those two added on to the usual 10, which you find in Exodus and repeated in Deuteronomy. So now, if a man love, Jesus' commandment was, love ye one another as I have loved you. What sort of love did Jesus have for others? Remember Jesus' name in the original Hebrew form is Yahshveh. Yod, He, Shein, Vav, He. Those are the letters. And you will see that that name consists of the sacred name Yahweh. Yod, He, Vav, He. The two parts, Yod, He and Vav, He, being joined by the Shein, Sha, Yahshveh. So the significance is that in Jesus, Yahweh became enfleshed, manifest in the ultimate possible concrete manner. That's what his name means, actually. They called him Son of God. They wouldn't call him God, but actually the correct thing would be to say that this was God incarnate. So that was the commandment he gave. Now how does the embodied God love? Isn't that a relationship where there is no rejection whatsoever of the loved one in any form or for any cause? That's the implication of that. This total and complete love, it is utterly selfless. It's easy for us to use words like that. I use the words quite easily, because I've got accustomed to speaking like this for the last 50 or 60 years. So it's easy enough to put it in verbal form. But selflessness is something of which we have little or no conception. We think we know what unselfishness means. When we talk about being unselfish, we are talking of being the opposite of selfish. Being selfish, we thoroughly understand. All human beings thoroughly understand the vices, the bad qualities, because it is our almost daily experience in some form or another. But the opposite is postulated as something good. And mankind, to a certain extent, is able to fulfill that opposite, which is the good. But this duality of the good and the evil exists embodied in him himself as he is, so that he is perpetually in a state of conflict. This psychical conflict prevents true perception. The mind is confused, it is beclouded, and one cannot see just what is what. So we live constantly trying to be unselfish and fighting against or trying to suppress the selfishness. But that can go on for your whole lifetime and not bear fruit, except in certain simple, obvious ways. But that is not the real thing. The real selflessness involves being completely free of all isolative and separative self-consciousness. I am I, and not anything or anybody else. Now, this is not true. There is no such thing anywhere in the world, in the animate or the inanimate sphere, of which it can be said that that is that and not anything else. The reason is simply this. Even modern science now has definitely come to the point where it says that there is nothing whatsoever in the universe but that it is completely and totally interrelated with and interacting with everything else in the universe. The universe is indeed one tremendous unitary wholeness. And the assertion of I and the assertion of you as somebody different and separate is the denial of love in its true sense. So, selflessness means that we are completely free from the consciousness of I am I, a separate self. It is the root source of all the conflict and evil and misery in the world. It's the root source of all that perpetuates disharmony, wrong relationships, and so forth. This kind of consciousness. Now, we must realize that this kind of consciousness has to be consciousness, not just a thought. I mean, it's easy enough to have a thought. I am not separate from you. You and I are completely interrelated. Even science, practical matter-of-fact science shows that. And then one proceeds to say, I believe that that is the truth. But that belief is impotent. Because you are actually conscious, we are actually conscious in terms of separateness. Consciousness is different from a state of mind or feeling, a belief or a conviction or an idea or any such thing. It's quite different from that. See, where you are truly conscious of any one thing, you are conscious immediately of the unity of the one total reality. You are immediately conscious of it. And in that consciousness, there can come no intrusion of separateness or isolativeness, of comparison, of demand, of expectation, and so forth. All that disappears because your consciousness embraces the totality. You follow? It's a tremendous thing. And it is in that. And you see, these great religious and spiritual teachers would not have said the things they said unless they had achieved them. If, for instance, you study the Buddha's own discourses where he talks about himself, you remember how he first went to Alara Kalama and he discovered from Alara himself that he could take his disciples up to the plane of no thing. Of no thing. Not nothing in the sense of a complete blank or a vacuity. And the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, as he then was very, very shrewdly percipient. And he thought, well, if this is the plane to which Alara Kalama can be conscious, I too have the vigor, the energy, the ability to become, to realize this state of consciousness. And he did. And he said to Alara afterwards that this is the case. And Alara said, that's very fine. Now we too can lead our group. You see? But the Buddha was not, the Buddha to be was not satisfied. He knew instinctively in his inner self that there is something still further to realize. And he goes to Uddaka Ramaputta, who takes him to the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Someday we'll talk about what on earth all this means. We can talk about it and talk intelligently about it, but we won't do it now at this moment. So the Buddha achieves that state of consciousness. And Uddaka Ramaputta is very pleased and would like to go into partnership, joint stock company. But the Buddha knew that there is something profounder, deeper than this. There is a final step to realize. And then he goes away and by himself realizes that state of consciousness, which in the Buddhist formulation is presented as the cessation of all perception and feeling. Now, ordinarily, the most brilliant of scholars, East and West alike, they would say, oh my goodness, you're an absolute goner now. If there is absolutely no perception and feeling, then it's like being annihilated or something like that. Not at all. The perception and feeling that Gautama referred to was the transcendental mode of perception and feeling. We must not think of it as our mode of feeling, our emotional sensitivities and so forth, you see, and our feeling sensitivities. It's something much, it's an octave. It's a totally different octave of being. And similarly with perception. In this perception, this transcendental perception, there is no conceptual thinking or discursive thinking of the sort that we experience and go through all through our life. Nothing like that. That perception is something really indescribable. And it is nondescript for the very simple reason that when you have gone to that stage where words no longer have specific, limited, binding meanings, that perception really refers to knowing consciously what cannot be expressed, either as concepts or as words. Now these are the things which the great mystics of the world, the Christian world included, realized very well. There is nothing to choose between the supreme presentations of the great Christian mystics and what the Buddha or Krishna or Zarathustra or anybody else presented. There is no difference between them. They are the same, if you really go deeply enough into it. So now, so much. If a man love me, and what the love means, he will keep my words. And he says, he has to use the word words, because there is no option where language is concerned. Language is limited, and you have to use the limited meanings of those words. Now, he will keep my words, but what exactly does this word signify? If you look into the Trismegistic writings, you will find something remarkably interesting. The presentation of the thought in the mind of God. Now, for us, any thought is a verbalized structure born of all our sense experiences synthesized by the activity of the brain to make a meaningful pattern. We have to bear that in mind very carefully, you see. That is our thinking. And that is a very limited expression of the possibility that lies within us. Now, God is not like John Brown or Mary Smith or somebody like that. God is that which is called God has no limitation, no existential being as you and I have. This is an existential being. It comes to birth, it will grow, and it will become old and decrepit and perish and die. And that's the finish of it. God is quite different from that, you see. So now, when we say the word, we use the phrase, my mind, what are we referring to? We are referring primarily to our brain activity, our thoughts and our feelings, our intellectual and emotional life. But this is not mind. This is the most limited aspect of mind. Mind in its reality is an archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy. And when that energy begins to manifest itself and releases cosmos out of chaos, it goes through all the grades of expression, and its final grade is what we call matter, solid matter. You see? So now God has the mind of God is something completely transcendent to anything that we can picture with respect to our own minds. You see? So now the thought in the mind of God will necessarily therefore be correspondingly different. And that thought in the mind of God is the Greek logos. You see? Logos. The word. That thought first became the primordial man, what is sometimes called the heavenly man, in Kabbalistic language, Adam Kadmon, and it is also associated with the signs of the zodiac. The total zodiac from Aries to Pisces is Adam Kadmon. There's so much involved in all this, it's impossible in the time at our disposal to talk all about it, but I just throw out a few simple things like this so that it may interest you and you'd come to know something. So now, the word, therefore, means the creative energy at work, which produces finally produces the concrete manifestation. You, me, all people, animals, plants, trees, etc., etc. You see? He will keep my words, and the words of the great religious teachers are concerned only with transcendence itself and the activity of transcendence. because the context of the fully opened up, enlightened religious consciousness is this transcendent context which functions in infinity, eternity and immortality. Our context is the finite, the temporal and the mortal. We belong to the realm of death. There's a lovely sentence in one of the Upanishads. I think the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. I can't recollect the whole sentence. But it has these words. And whose source is death? Source, you know. Not HP source, but whose source is death. So now, we belong to the realm of death. But the words and what the great teachers presented and actually exemplified in their own living being, they were the living manifestations of the Logos, or the Logoi, actually, so many words. You see, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him. Now, of course, the whole of Christendom, with the exception of the great mystics who really realized the deep truths, the whole of Christendom thinks of God as Father in a way which is very similar to, analogous to, the way in which you and I as good Christians think of our own fleshly father. Someone who is kind and nice and good, occasionally gives a spank, but that's neither here nor there, and brings toys to me, the child, gives me what I like, and so on and so on. The giver of all good things, as we say. That's the concept of father. But father, in the Hebrew, Abba, really means he who comes out of the unknown and the unknowable. That is my Father. And the Father in heaven, heaven is Chokhmah, which is wisdom. In Buddhist terms, the wisdom gone beyond. You find it in the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom gone beyond. So now, think, that consciousness which emerges out of the unknown and the unknowable, the absolute, that is the Father in heaven, in wisdom. And my Father will love him, and we will come unto him. Now, what is this sort of love? It's a state of permanent. I have no other word in the language to use but to say timeless conjugation, in terms of the consciousness which is at one with your own individual consciousness, completely at one. And it can be completely at one only if one is, the psyche is completely purified. If the psyche is impure, well, that naturally resists the transcendent. This is why the fundamental basis in all the great religions is the moral code. The living of the purely moral life, which releases wholeness. That psychophysical wholeness, which is perfect psychophysical health, which is the meaning of holiness. Then the individual person no longer resists, no longer obstructs this transcendent energy from functioning through him. He is the perfected holy one. The phrase, I think, which was first presented by the Buddha. I think the Hindus had other terms. But the Buddha presented this, the perfected holy ones, the arahats. The arahats were the perfected holy ones. Those whose conduct was the perfect expression of transcendent goodness. And Zarathustra also emphasized that. Right through the Zarathustrian religion, you find holiness, perfect purity, taking pride of place in the religious life. If that is there as the foundation, all the rest comes. So now, that is the sort of promise. My Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him, which simply means function through that person.